Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
I really feel confident that if more than one person knows what happened to Jason, the more publicity we can get and the more questions that are asked, eventually the truth very well may come out, even after all these years.
These are the efforts that we are taking in the Cold Case Homicide Unit. You have to understand we're very passionate about our jobs, and we speak, our motto is that we speak for those who can't speak themselves, right? No one knows where Jason is, so we have to be that voice.
Because I always kind of had this hope he was alive. The stories, the NCIS presentation, like, oh my gosh, they probably killed him. I can't imagine why.
In June of 1991, 20-year-old Jason Dyes returned from Operation Desert Storm when the USS Horn docked in San Diego, California. Jason was now on leave and had a month to report to a new duty station in Pensacola, Florida. Jason never showed up and was classified as an unauthorized absentee and later a deserter. Before Jason disappeared, he mailed some packages back to his family in Louisiana. He phoned them and asked them not to open the packages. The mystery of what was in the packages and what happened to Jason loomed over his family for years. What had he sent them? Military secrets? Was there some kind of conspiracy? When Jason's younger cousin grew up, she embarked on a journey to find out what happened to him. She opened the packages and started pressing for answers. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 229 of The Vanished, Jason Dyes' story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Jason's story is quite mysterious. No one was really looking for him for a couple of decades, beyond the Navy making some small efforts to track down a deserter. To help figure out what may have happened to Jason, we wanted to learn more about who he was. For this story, we spoke to Jason's cousin, Rachel, who was able to give us some background information on Jason's childhood.
He's 9 years older than me. When he was about 8, his dad died from cancer. And my aunt kind of had a nervous breakdown after that. And so she had put him in a boys' country, like a boarding school, I guess, in Texas. So he was there for a while growing up, and then he lived with my grandparents in Lafayette for a little while. We would see my grandparents almost every weekend, sometimes, you know, during the week too. So we were over there a couple times during the week. So we saw Jason a lot.
After Jason went to live with his grandparents in Lafayette, Louisiana, Rachel got to spend a lot more time with her cousin. She has many fond memories from this time.
My earliest memories start maybe around 5, 6. But I know, like, his dad died when he was 8, and then 4 years later, my little brother died. So Jason really had a hard time, because we were like his brother and sister. So he had a hard time with that, from what I've been told. He withdrew into himself. He was quiet and reserved. I don't know if he was always like that, or maybe just the deaths contribute to that. But he was a real reserved person. He liked computers, but he had a really good sense of humor. I remember he used to pick he took any opportunity he could to like tease people in a nice way. You know, he wouldn't mean. He would pick, he'd make up goofy nicknames for people. And I always tried to impress him because to me, he was so cool. I just remember thinking he was the coolest person ever. And when we'd go over to my grandma's, he would let me in his room. So I would try to keep myself in check. I remember just keeping my hands to my sides because my first reaction being little, I wanted to go grab and look at all his stuff and his computers and his games and dig around. And I didn't want to, you know, bother him. So I remember trying to make him think I was responsible and mature and cool and, you know, not bother him so he would kick me out of his room. I remember he would be doing stuff on his computer or taking notes. And every now and then he would look up and he'd kind of just smile at me. And he was just acknowledging that I was there. And it made me feel good. It made me feel special. Like, and he'd kind of just give me this little quirky smile and then go back to doing what he was doing. He'd pat me on the head whenever I walked by. And he liked, there was this movie. Oh my gosh, it terrified me. It was called Maximum Overdrive. It was a crazy movie. This comet or an asteroid hit Earth and it made all the electronic devices go crazy. Like blenders and things were starting to attack people. And he loved that movie. He would watch that movie. And I guess because it was about computers. It was like probably all the rage in the 80s. I don't know. I was little. So I was like, I don't want him to think I'm a baby. He loved 21 Jump Street. Johnny Depp, he tried to do his hair like him and stuff. And I remember he used to try to get a tan because he was kind of pale, but he would try to get a tan. I guess in the 80s, that's what he did. I don't know. He laid out on a chair and he had this half square metal thing that would reflect the sunlight. And so he would lay out with that and try to get a tan. He would push us on the swing at my grandparents' place. They had a big old porch swing, but it was hung from a big oak tree. They had huge oak trees in their yard, live oaks. He would push me and my little brother on the oak and he'd run around and play with the dogs. My grandma had all these little poodles and things that she loved and he would make up goofy names for them and play around with them. Those are, you know, because we were kind of far apart in age. I guess 9 years makes a difference, you know, when you're a teenager and you have a little 9-year-old cousin. But he let us into his world as much as he could, you know, when we come to my grandparents' place. I don't remember him ever having friends over there.
Jason was known to be a responsible teenager who focused on the goals he had for after graduation.
He didn't have trouble in high school or anything like that. He wasn't a mean person. He didn't get into fights and he never did drugs. My parents said he didn't drink and he didn't do drugs. My aunt said he stood up to a bully in school one time. There was this other person bullying this other kid and he stood up to the bully and punched the bully in the face. And so he kind of stood up for the underdog. He was a confident teenager and he didn't get into trouble and he knew what he wanted to do.
After high school, Jason made the decision to join the United States Navy, where he could pursue his interests further.
The first Navy test he took to get into the Navy, and I don't think he did very well. And then he took it again. He did really well. And that's when he went into the Navy in, I think it was 89. And I was 9 or 10 when he left for the Navy. And so then we didn't see him. I wrote letters to him when he was in the Navy. He loved computers. Being in the Navy, being an EW, electronic warfare technician, and then going to be a cryptologist, you know, that's what he was going to do at Corey Station. That was his element. That was his thing. He just loved computers and games, and he was always really into what he was doing. When it came to that kind of stuff, he was real serious.
During his time in the Navy, Jason worked as an electronic warfare technician and was assigned to the USS Horn during Operation Desert Storm. Jason had decided to re-enlist, and after the Horn docked in San Diego, California, he was going to attend school to be a cryptologist. In June of 1991, Jason was on leave from the Navy. He was last seen in San Diego, California on June 18, 1991. He was due to report to a naval station in Pensacola, Florida a month later, on July 18, but never showed up. They labeled his absence as unauthorized and later classified him as a deserter. Rachel told us how her family learned that Jason was missing.
My grandparents said the Navy, two officers had come out to their house looking for Jason in Lafayette. And they said they came in the house and they looked around. They said they even went and looked in the attic looking for him, I guess, because they thought he was a deserter. So they were looking for him. They searched the property and they didn't find him. And then that was it. And I think that kind of threw my grandparents and everybody into confusion. That's when they called my dad and my mom over, and me, and we all went over there, and they were saying, hey, something happened to Jason. He went, you know, he's missing.
Jason's family believed that the U.S. Navy was investigating his disappearance, and he wasn't reported missing to another agency until 2013, when Rachel reported him missing to the Escambia County Sheriff's Office. Pensacola is in Escambia County, and that is where Jason was due to report in July. Before Jason disappeared, he called his family in Louisiana and told them that he had mailed some packages to them, but asked them not to open them. The packages arrived, and they did as Jason had asked and didn't open them.
My great aunt, she lived just a few houses away from my grandma. They were sisters, and that's the one Jason had mailed the packages to. And she hadn't told anyone about the packages up until that point because Jason called her and said, just keep the packages safe. You know, so that's what she did.
The mystery of these packages nagged at Jason's family, but they continued to honor his wishes not to open them. They came up with various theories as to what could be inside the packages and if they had something to do with his disappearance. Here's Rachel with more.
They had all these weird conspiracy theories, and my aunt, Jason's mom, she made everything really dramatic. She kind of fed into that panic and chaos. My grandparents, and they were all ignorant of how the Navy worked. My grandma, they were real, not anything against religious people, but they were very religious and kind of superstitious along with that. So I think it would, none of that stuff helped. It's like none of them really used common sense. They all just kind of went into panic mode. And I think it was my mom. She was like, maybe there's CDs in the boxes when they got the boxes. So it was that kind of confusion. It was just a fear of the unknown. Like, who's going to be afraid of CDs? But back then, these computers and all these new things, it could be spy stuff. And they were all kind of panicking. My grandpa read a lot of John Grisham books. I think that's what went with the conspiracy stuff, because my grandpa was all about conspiracy. He was like, Jason probably got killed in a war game and they're covering it up.
Those packages sat in storage for years while Jason's family came up with theory upon theory about the contents. When Rachel was older, she was able to convince her family to open them. Instead of finding military secrets, they found presents. The family now believes that Jason had intended on visiting with them on his trip from San Diego to Pensacola, and sent the packages in advance so he could give them to his family when he made it to Louisiana.
And looking back, he probably did that because he knew me and my brother, and we were always at my grandparents, and I think he wanted to give us those presents that were in there, and he didn't want us to bust into the packages before he got there and was able to give it to us. So he sent them to her house because her house was safe. When she found out that the Navy had come over, she said, oh my gosh, and she came over. She's like, he called me and told me to keep these packages safe. I have these. Everybody was like, oh my goodness, you know, what could they be? What could they be? And I was sitting in there and I was like, open them. Let's see what they are. They didn't. They said, oh, maybe drugs, which I have no idea why they said that, because he didn't do drugs. He didn't smoke weed. He didn't smoke cigarettes. He didn't do any of that stuff. Even before he went in, he was a serious person, you know, he was into his computers. And so I don't know why they said, I think they just went into panic mode and they started with the conspiracy theories. Jason's mom, I loved her, but she was just kind of dingy. Sometimes she would say he was telepathic and an indigo child. But I had to look up indigo child. And she said the government was doing remote sensing. And she thought they were using Jason's telepathic powers for stuff. And, you know, she didn't even want to give DNA at first. She fed into that confusion and chaos a lot. She had a lot of influence over my grandma and grandpa. And my mom and dad were just kind of like, she's kooky dukes. It was, you know, it was up to her ultimately to find Jason instead of just focusing on facts and trying to figure out. She would call the NASIC, NCIC, and she would call them up. And I don't even know how those conversations went, but they probably thought she's just a lunatic. So nothing ever happened.
As Rachel was growing up, she wasn't sure what was happening with Jason's case, but she never forgot about her cousin. All she knew was that every year the Navy would call looking for Jason.
I think on the anniversary when Jason went AWOL, I think in September, when they declared him a deserter, every year they would call back to my grandparents' house. I guess just checking. I guess it's maybe protocol. They have to do that. And it would throw my aunt into a tizzy all over again. They're calling me again. I don't know what's going on. And you couldn't reason with her, especially as she got older. She had diabetes and she wasn't taking her medication. So it just, everything was compounded.
While Jason was classified as a deserter, Rachel doesn't believe that is actually what happened. Jason had plans and everything points to Jason planning to make the trip to Florida.
I don't think he deserted is the thing. I don't think he deserted at all. I think he was going to come back and, you know, give those gifts to us. It was like horn memorabilia and stuff. I think he was going to give us those things and go on to Quarry Station and go about, you know, in his career being a cryptologist. So I don't think he deserted. I don't think he would have even been able to because he didn't have a driver's license. That was one thing that we found out.
Rachel told us what she thinks happened to her cousin.
I think he was murdered by some of his crewmates. And I think they're covering up something that happened. They didn't like Jason. It was reported that they didn't like him, his chief and another guy. It was knowledge that they didn't like him. They forced him to dress in drag when he didn't want to. For the crossing of the line ceremony, they put him like in extra galley duty, I think they called it. It was just things to torment him. And then his chief sent in a letter that was really a defamatory letter. When I think about why, that's honestly what I kind of think, that maybe it was some sort of bullying, picking on him, and it got out of hand, and he died, and they covered it up. And now it's coming up all these years later because they didn't cover their butts good enough.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, and you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Several years ago, Rachel started to pursue Jason's case more aggressively. She reported him missing in Escambia County and got NCIS to open up a cold case investigation. At the same time, she was doing her own investigation as well, trying to track down those who worked closely with Jason during his time in the Navy, especially those last few months and weeks before he disappeared. We asked investigators handling Jason's case to speak with us, but they weren't able to get approval to comment. Instead, they pointed us to a presentation that they did in 2019. In this presentation, NCIS laid out Jason's case at the USS Horn reunion in an attempt to reach someone who may have known Jason. We were able to obtain the audio from that presentation, but be aware that this was presented in front of a large group, and sometimes you can hear a little noise from the audience.
For those of you who attended either the 2016 or the 2017 D.C. reunion, you know about the case of our shipmate, Jason William Dyes. And for those of you who don't, Jason, also known as Bill, served on Horn during Desert Storm, and upon return from the war, was given orders to EW School at Corey Station, Florida. On June 18th, he called a relative and said he was sending some packages, and that was the last time anybody ever heard from Jason. He never showed up in Florida. Nobody's ever heard from him since, and he's been missing nearly 28 years now. His cousin, Rachel Burke, spearheaded an effort to find out what happened to Jason. That effort finally started getting some traction shortly after our 2016 San Antonio reunion. That's when NCIS opened up a cold case investigation. And tonight, I'm very pleased to have with us Special Agent Sean Keefe with the NCIS Cold Case Homicide Unit.
Give you guys an inside look into something most people never get to see, and that's an active NCIS investigation. We would normally never be sharing this information with the public, but because it's been 28 years since EW3 Dyes has disappeared, we're going to be bold, and we're going to be upfront, and we're going to share information. And there's going to be stuff in here that might ruffle some people's feathers. I would rather solve a missing persons case or potentially a homicide case than offend somebody. If I offend you, I apologize, because there's going to be some information shared about shipmates aboard the USS Horn, and you'll see that along here. We're just sharing facts of what we know, what we've discovered in our investigation, and I'm basically asking you for help, because there's a lot of information that we don't know as NCIS that only you guys, those who served with him, have. So this is me making a plea. This is NCIS making a plea. Help us solve the disappearance of EW3 Jason Dyes. This is an NCIS cold case investigation. I'm going to walk you through all the steps of this. So who was EW3 Dyes? There's a picture from his cruise book. How many people remember that return to home port in Desert Storm? That picture there. Okay, so here's some pictures of Jason growing up. We like to show this to people to remind people that he's just not a name, but he was a person who has a family, a very close family, who love him and miss him and want to know where he is. Okay, so here's his Navy career. Began active duty on May 16th, 1989. Earned his EW rate and was assigned. His first assignment was the USS Horn. And he arrived on board in December 1990.
Special Agent Sean Keith went on to name some of Jason's shipmates, because they are looking to speak with these men and learn more information about them.
Okay, here's the rest of his shipmates, his shop, the EWs. I don't know if anybody remembers any of these individuals. We got Chief EWC John Williamson. We have EW3 Christopher Robert England. EW3 Richard Mark Christensen. We have EW3 John August Sloan. We have EWSN Mike McNeil and EWSA Stephen Herrick. And then those not listed, they weren't in the cruise book pictures. We have EW2 Duda, EW1 Harris, and EW3 Payne. So here's where the story starts. June 7th, 1991, USS Horn pulls into San Diego, returned from its Desert Storm deployment.
Special Agent Keith then explained that recently, someone came forward and reported that he remembers visiting with the electronic warfare guys at the naval station in San Diego shortly after returning home from Desert Storm, and he remembered interacting with Jason Dyes. What information they were seeking from the crowd was if anyone remembered what barracks the shipmates were stationed at after they returned home. It's been difficult to trace what may have happened to Jason after so many years, but they've been going back and trying to interview everyone they can find who would have been there around that time.
So it's interesting that though we've conducted numerous interviews of people, this recent report is the only person who claims to have seen EW3 Dyes after you guys returned home from Desert Storm. Which is very strange, because there's some people who would have interacted with him. Shops are very close. He didn't have any family in the area. He would have hung out with friends from the Navy, friends from... The only people he knows was on the ship, was on the USS Horn. So, Here's some possibilities. What may have happened? We think this could have happened afterwards. Was there a gathering celebration? EW3 Christensen got married 2 days. Got married June 9th, 1991 in Las Vegas. Married Monique. And they lived together. They were one of the few people that lived together off base at what, at the time, I'm sure it's probably still very nice, was a swanky apartment complex. Or it seemed to be a nice apartment complex. Canyon Ridge Apartments, off base in San Diego. So we assumed that there were probably some sort of parties, you know, post-deployment parties, some sort of celebration, whether it be marriage or just a post-deployment celebration. We think that something happened there.
Beyond this possible wedding celebration, they believe that Jason may have attended some Angels baseball games around the time that he disappeared. The reason they believe this is that they found out that he had purchased 2 Angels hats and an Angels jersey at a place called Pro Image in La Mesa, California on June 17, 1991, the day before Jason was last seen. The next thing they know that he did was mail those packages back to his family in Louisiana the following day, June 18th. This was Jason's last known financial transaction. Special Agent Keith noted that while Jason mailed these from San Diego, Jason listed his new address in Florida as the return address on the packages, indicating that he did, in fact, plan to travel there. After this, there are no more traces of Jason. He was on leave, so he didn't have to report anywhere for a month. That has left them with quite a bit of time that something could have happened to Jason. Here's Special Agent Keith again.
He was supposed to report to Corey Station July 18th, 1991, 1 month later. So we have a month that something could have happened. EW3 dies, should have reported to C-School. He did not report to his new command. He was subsequently designated a deserter in the United States Navy, and a warrant for his arrest was activated in NCIC. That's a database that National Law Enforcement uses to track people who have active warrants, people who need to be picked up. So if someone turns up in South Dakota that has a warrant issued somewhere, you know, from California for being a deserter, they're going to be able to know that and pick them up. So anywhere in the country this person turns up, they would see the warrant and he would be returned to the military. The arrest warrant was active until December of 2017. He remains listed as a missing person in NCIC. Rachel Burke, his cousin, she reported EW3 dies as a missing person in Escambia County, Florida. I believe that's where Corey Station is, Pensacola. So she figured that would be the best place to file a missing persons report because he was supposed to be there. So Rachel has been searching for her cousin ever since he didn't show up. And so her efforts included reaching out to as many people she could find who might have known her cousin.
This is when Rachel enlisted the help of a man named Joe. Joe and Jason were shipmates, but Joe told us that they didn't really know each other. Here's Joe.
Sadly, kind of in retrospect, I really never knew Jason on the ship. We had a crew of about 500. He worked in combat systems as an electronics warfare technician, and I was an interior communications electrician who worked in engineering. And you usually knew people on the ship based on who you worked with and who you lived with in the berthing, who you, you know, basically shared bunks with. I'm pretty sure his berthing was all the way up toward the forward end of the ship, and mine was pretty far back toward the aft part of the ship. So I'm positive we crossed paths many times. It's just that I didn't know him. As far as the people in his shop, the other electronic warfare technicians, EWs, we called them, there were about 6 or 7 in his shop, I believe, and I only knew one of them, an EW to England.
You're probably wondering what role Joe plays in this story, since he didn't know Jason. Well, Joe started a website that became important in Rachel's search for answers.
The ship was decommissioned and eventually towed away off into mothballs. I just started to make it a long story. I started wondering what happened to my old ship. This was probably around the year 2000. I was curious as to what happened to the ship and started searching on the internet. I couldn't find anything about it, and I wound up starting a website for the ship, USSHorn.net. because I had this website, eventually Jason's cousin started her search to try to figure out what happened to Jason and contacted the commanding officer, Captain Barnett, and he knew of my website, and I had stayed in fairly close contact with the captain. And so he contacted me, you know, because I have the website, I can put the word out. Did you guys know our shipmate went missing way back in 1991? That's when I put up a flyer. I think this was around 2013. I put up a flyer on the website, you know, a missing flyer. If you have any information on Jason Dies, that kind of thing, with a telephone number to the Escambia County Sheriff's Department in Florida, which is where Rachel, Jason's cousin, had filed a missing persons report. And that's how I kind of started to get involved and traded emails with Rachel, trying to get the word out, and also just to find out what people knew about him, if they knew that he had disappeared, that kind of thing. And then eventually, by asking questions to some of his shipmates who did work with him, I was kind of surprised to find out that most of them, actually pretty much everybody I talked to, did not even know that he had disappeared.
It was on Joe's website that Rachel found someone who worked closely with Jason.
Rachel reported that while searching for answers, EW3 Sloan seemed to purposefully avoid her attempts at communicating with him. So what she does is she confronts him on the open forum on the USS Horn website. He calls her. Because she confronts him, basically calls him out. He calls her, makes contact with her. She wants to know, like, do you know my cousin? Why aren't you reaching out to me? Tell me the things that you know about him. I want to try to find him. He says he denied ever knowing. Jason Dies. You saw how small that shop was, right? And his explanation was they worked on a separate shift, so that's why. Does that sound plausible?
No.
Just saying the facts, what people say. So, missing poster was published on the USS Horn website. Interesting. One of the first people to call Escambia County, Florida, was EW3 Sloan. Now, he says, I was a crewmate of EW3 Dies. Contradictory to what? I mean, he did admit that he was a crewmate, but he said he didn't know him. Now, all of a sudden, this is what he reports to Escambia County. He says, when he, Sloan, reported to C-School, he learned that Dies never showed up. So they were going to go, they might not have been going to the same school, but they were going to the same base. So he learned, he never showed up. So he called Escambia County, whatever, 2013, 2014, and decided to make this report. He said he telephoned the USS Horn and talked with EW3 Christensen. Remember, that was the guy that lived off base with Monique, who he married 2 days after he returned. Said he telephoned USS Horn in 1991 and talked with EW3 Christensen. EW3 Christensen, this is according to Sloan, said that Dies had been caught in New York while attempting to cash a check using military identification. That's all he said. Nothing further. This is what he reported to the Florida police. So, that could potentially be a sign of life of someone, right? We're looking for signs of life of someone. A shipmate the same year saying he was caught in New York trying to cash a check using military ID. I don't understand what that means. I didn't know it was illegal to cash a check using military ID, but...
Rachel told us more about her interactions with Sloan.
One of the guys, Sloan, I found him. I had trouble finding these guys, but he was easy enough to find because he was on the Horn site. And then, you know, we met Joe, and Joe started putting up flyers of Jason, saying this guy, you know, he was a crewmate of y'all and he never showed up, and kind of just telling his story. And so Joe first did that in 2013, I think. Joe put up the first post about Jason being missing, and then Sloan commented on it, said something, I knew he never made it to Corey Station, but I didn't know he never made it anywhere. Sloan was at EW with him, and Sloan then, you know, he called Escambia County, from what I understand. And he told them about this New York rumor about Jason being caught in New York writing bad checks or something. That was never true. The Navy had no record of that. Jason was never caught anywhere writing bad checks anywhere. They have no record of it. It never showed up on any of the police reports. Because Jason's face is out everywhere. It's on Interpol. And he said he had called back to Christensen, and that's who told him that. And Christensen was the one that didn't like him. And Christensen was shortly kicked out of the Navy after that on drug charges. And they said it was widely known that Christensen was a drug abuser while he was out there. And he had really bad marks in the Navy before he met Chief Williamson. And Chief Williamson and him became really good buddies, and neither one of them liked Jason. And I think it was probably because Jason did his work the way he was supposed to, because he was a serious person, and he wasn't in their little in-group of partiers. And I think, you know, they said that they did pick on him. You know, they did things to him. It was clear. Stephen Herrick said it was clear to him that they didn't like Jason. They made it clear. And then the chief, you know, it took him a year before he mailed anything in about Jason being a deserter. It was close to a year. And then when he did mail the stuff in, he wrote a nasty letter. To me, it's an ugly letter because they said it's defaming. And it just made fun of Jason, saying he had 500 pounds of gun magazines, not like magazines like, you know, which you put ammo in, but magazines about how to build bombs and different things. 500 pounds. I knew Sloan was acting weird with me because he reported in 2013, you know, to the Escambia County Sheriff that he knew Jason had been caught, or he thought Jason had been caught in New York, and he called back to the ship and he talked to Christensen. And they said that's just crazy because people didn't have cell phones back in 91. So you had to be looking for someone. Steve Herrick just said that Jason never caused trouble on board, because the chief said Jason was a troublemaker. The captain said, I have no record of Jason ever coming to captain's mass. Captain Barnett said Jason wasn't a troublemaker. The chief is making it up, maybe. The chief couldn't produce any of those records either, that Jason was a troublemaker. So Christensen and the chief were buddy-buddy. Christensen was a drug addict. You know, he was kicked out shortly after they got back from Iraq. I think Smeester said, and he's not sure the exact date, but he said he thinks it was 92 that Christensen was finally kicked out. Once he got out from under Williamson's protection, I don't know, he was kicked out of the Navy on drug charges. That's what they said. And he's, you know, they got his mugshot. He was arrested just like a year ago. You know, he's been, they said, in and out his whole life since he got kicked out of the Navy, just constant petty crime, drug charges. I think they busted him for meth something. I looked it up, like a meth lab or something. Sloan, on the other hand, he seems to be, you know, have his life together. He's a pilot. He seems to have everything going for him. I don't know anything about the chief.
During the 2019 presentation, Special Agent Keith went on to explain that they haven't found any signs of life since Jason mailed those packages in 1991. They've obtained DNA from Jason's family members to compare to any unidentified remains. They've also done NCIC searches to see if he ever had any run-ins with the law. Here's Special Agent Keith again.
As long as NCIC has been around, we're able to track whose name has ever popped up around this country, who has maybe stopped for a traffic violation, who has anything that their name would pop up. We just heard that EW3 Christian said that he was caught in New York for cashing bad checks, right? That means police involvement. That means they would have run his name. That means he probably would have been arrested. No hits. His name never pops up.
Even though Jason was considered a deserter, Special Agent Keith doesn't believe this to be the case.
Was he really a deserter? I want to throw it out to you. I want you guys to start to ponder. I want you to process this case. Let's look at the facts of what we have. Look at some of the things that contradict one another. I want to start a conversation. So, was he really a deserter? So our interaction with EW3 Sloan. Sloan said he learned from EW3 Christensen, Sloan, the guy who he said he had been caught in New York attempting to cash a check with military ID. He avoided Rachel Burke and denied knowing EW3 Dives. To this day, he has avoided an interview with NCIS. We can't force someone to interview or to speak with us. He will not speak with us. Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense from what Sloan told us that Christensen said.
Based on the little information that they have dug up, they seem to be suspicious of Sloan and Christensen. But there's more. More that seems to suggest a possible cover-up by their chief. Special Agent Keith explained this further.
Interaction with his chief, EWC Williamson. According to Williamson, EW3 Dias was not very likable. At least not to him. Some shipmates warned him EW3 Dias was going to desert from the Navy. And he said that EW3 Dias intending on deserting was common knowledge. He said that you know, everybody knows this. Everybody knows that he's pretty vocal. He wants out, and he's not going to report. Williamson also said that EW3 Dyes was a poor sailor who was frequently in trouble with command, who went to captain's mass frequently, was basically just a troubled sailor, and a lot of people didn't like him. Now, EWC Williamson sent a letter almost a full year after he went missing. He sent a letter and a package to the Navy Absentee Collection and Information Center, NASIC. I'm going to give you a glimpse into what he sent. This is, now keep in mind, this is coming from his chief to a missing sailor. Here's the letter that he writes. I'm going to read it to you. As you can see from some of the literature, Mr. Dyes is a gun survivalist nut and could be armed. He had over 500 pounds of gun magazines, Soldier of Fortune, Anarchist Cookbook, which is a book about how to make bombs, guns and ammo. Even though he doesn't look very threatening, he's one of those people I never turn my back to. I know Priscilla Dyes' mother. His father's deceased. I hope you like the pictures. Keep me informed. If I get any more information, I'll forward it on to you. P.S. The photo of him not in drag. He wears round-rimmed glasses. He's blind without them. The pictures that he sent to NASIC, the missing sailor from your crew, this is what he sent. He sent two pictures of him in drag from the crossing in line ceremony and his crew cook photo. And it seems to be defamatory in nature that he wants to send a picture showing him in drag. That's what it appears to be. I think it's pretty clear that Williamson didn't like Dyes. Here's what we also found out. EWC Williamson was unable to recall who told him that Dyes was intending on deserting. He just didn't remember. He was also unable to recall who might also, even though it was common knowledge, he doesn't know who else would have known. EW3 Dyes' crewmates suggest EW3 Dyes was not as EWC Williamson described him. Other people that we interviewed, his crewmates, the people that worked with him, gave us contradicting information from what his chief said. A reference to over 500 pounds of gun magazines in EWC Williamson's correspondence is unreasonable to this point. We found no evidence to suggest that. Including the photographs depicting EW3 Dyes in drag, without explanation, it doesn't seem fair. It seems to be like he's trying to make a statement. He didn't send any of Dyes' military records or his reviews, the very things that he said. He was a poor sailor, he didn't do good. He didn't send him any of his fit reps, any of his military records. We have almost no record of EW3 Dyes' career in the military. We don't know. He never sent it. EWC Williamson and EW3 Christensen were reportedly very close. When Christensen joined the military, he was made it very clear, it was very known that he abused drugs. And in his previous commands, he received very low fit reps because he was a drug abuser and got in trouble a lot, drunk and disorderly, AWOL, reckless driving, those sorts of things. Interesting, he reports to the USS Horn, becomes buddies with Williamson, all of a sudden he starts getting high marks. He was eventually separated from the military, from the USS Horn, for abusing drugs. Since leaving the USS Horn, Christensen has been arrested multiple times for violating civilian drug laws. Now keep in mind, this is the person that said that he has the only proof of him being alive after he went missing for trying to cash a check using military ID. Is that statement reliable?
There appears to have been a smear campaign waged against Jason after his mysterious disappearance, headed by Chief Williamson. In an effort to see if any of this information was true, they've talked to other people who were on the ship.
EWSA Herrick spoke to him recently. Here's what he said. Dyes did not cause any trouble on board the USS Horn. It was apparent to him that Williamson and Christensen did not like EW3 Dyes. It was standard for new sailors to be assigned to the galley, right? EW3 Dyes was assigned as normal, just like everybody else. However, even though he wasn't the most junior rank person, Williamson put him in for a second duty, even though he was higher ranked than some other people. During the crossing of the line ceremony, you saw those pictures of him in drag, right? I've been there when they did the crossing of the line ceremony. He was assigned to dress as a female, even though he didn't want to. He was forced to. Captain Barnett, his general impression, recollection of EW3 Dyes, was as a valued member of the USS Horn's Combat Information Center watch team. And according to Captain Barnett's recollections, they're consistent that Dyes was not charged with offenses. We don't have an actual record of those captain's masks, all that trouble that Williamson said that he was in. We just don't have a record of it. Same thing Commander Nessel wrote. He recognized that he endorsed EW3 Dyes' rating conversion, which is indicative that he was a successful professional. He wouldn't have put him further for advancement if he was a troubled sailor. He recalls Dyes wanted a new challenge. EW was not a challenge enough for him. He wanted to be a cryptologic technician, which is part of what his training was, the incentive of going to Corey Station. He was on the career track to advancement. Like, he was going to go to a place where he wanted to go.
Special Agent Keith mentioned speaking to Captain Barnett. We were able to chat with Captain Barnett, too. He told us more about what he remembers of Jason.
You know, I had 400-plus guys aboard the ship, even 500 at the time in Desert Storm when we were in the Persian Gulf. He re-enlisted, and so, you know, we were always keen to encourage sailors to make a career out of it. And that was the first opportunity to really go to a career school and have further assignments in a career field. And as an electronic warfare specialist, he was in a very, very good high-demand field, and that school was a very good school, and I would have been very happy to re-enlist him in the Navy and have a good sailor continue in a Navy career. So then the re-enlistment, when he re-enlisted to go to the school in advanced electronic warfare, was the one time that I would have definitely been working with him, because I would have done the re-enlistment ceremony.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. Special Agent Keith went into further detail about why he believes Jason was not a deserter.
Here's what we believe. Here's why we believe he did not desert. There's no sign of life after June 18th, 1991, which is extremely difficult. If you really are alive, you're going to pop up somewhere. But there's no sign of life for 28 years. He had strong family ties, close connections with his family. No one's ever seen or heard from him again. He thought very highly of his father, who was a military veteran who died in 1979. It seems unlikely that someone he held in high regard and someone who he was trying to follow in his footsteps would turn around and betray his country by deserting the Navy. He did not access his credit union account, which had more than $500 in it. It remains to this day. It's been turned over to the state of California. No one's ever claimed it. He never took any money. He did not have a driver's license entering into the United States Navy, never obtained a driver's license, didn't have time. He didn't have a car. So how was he intending to get to Corey Station? This is one of the things that we don't know. no substantiated claims of intention to desert, even though Williamson said it, and one other sailor, EW3 England, mentioned something similar. No one else claims to have a knowledge of this well-known common knowledge that Williamson said that he was intending on deserting. So, remember that package that I showed you earlier? He had that listed as his new address. It doesn't line up. That's not what someone who would desert would do. Military records pertaining to EW3 dives. This is what I said earlier. We have almost no record of it. Whoever was the custodian of that, whether that was Chief Williamson, he didn't send any of that to NASIC. We don't have any of that information.
One thing that Special Agent Keith talked about was that Jason never had a driver's license and didn't have a vehicle on the base. No one knows how he planned to travel from California to Florida, with a possible stop in Louisiana. Was he going to take a bus or a plane? We just don't know. While we were speaking with Joe, he remembered his time in the Navy and how they used to get around if they didn't have their own transportation.
I've talked to lots of shipmates about this. I've talked to relatives. I've talked to Rachel. We're always just kind of kicking ideas back and forth. But as far as we know, he didn't have any car. He didn't have any driver's license. So he would need transportation to either the airport or the bus station or the train station. And to me, it just seems pretty basic that you would get that transportation from somebody that you know on the ship. We could have taken taxis and stuff like that, but that was always kind of a luxury. Whenever we traveled from the ship to another duty station, we had to go to the airport. We would just have a friend take us. And he shipped these boxes. He mailed some packages to his relatives in Louisiana, I believe it was. So it seems to me that he wants to travel light. He doesn't want to be carrying these boxes with him. So that again tells me he probably didn't have his own car. Otherwise, he'd just take the boxes in his car and not have to pay for the shipping. So he's traveling light and he disappears. Nobody ever hears from him. You know, maybe it's a little bit of a stretch and a little too much speculation, but it seems to me that he didn't get too far from the ship and something happened to him.
Captain Barnett explained the process when a sailor is detached from one duty station and assigned to another, and how this process played a role in Jason's disappearance going unnoticed for some time.
So once you detach a sailor from your ship or your duty station, he now belongs to the next station. So when he's given his orders and he's given a folder full of his pay record and stuff, nowadays it's all automated. You don't necessarily do it. But in those days, the personnel office would package up his records and his military-related paperwork, like his medical record, for example, right? So all that gets packaged up, and he takes that with him to his next duty station. So once he leaves the ship, you drop track on him. The next station's supposed to pick him up. When you detach him, you're supposed to let the next station know that you've detached him. So you don't know anything until somebody contacts you and says he's missing. In those days, we didn't have databases. The most exotic computer we had, certainly aboard ship, was a Zenith 246 or something like that. They were floppy disk was the state of the art. I mean, you could take a floppy disk and carry it to the next computer and stick it in. And that was the way things got moved, but mostly by paper. So anyway, so the rest of this, the connection would be, how would we know he was missing? We really wouldn't know he was missing until his cousin, Rachel Burke, contacted Pensacola or Escambia County, which is where Pensacola and Corey Station are located in that county, asking for information on him.
Many of us don't have military experience, so hearing from Joe was really helpful. He offered a possible motive to harm Jason back in June of 1991.
I did some traveling myself at this time, obviously, between duty stations. Even while I was on Horn, I went to school in Great Lakes, for example. One time we were in Hawaii, and I traveled from Hawaii to Great Lakes, and we dealt with a lot of cash. So I'm just thinking the simplest explanation is probably the explanation. And that is that he had probably, well, he probably had his current pay, you know, whatever he was owed at the time he left the Horn. And they probably gave him advance pay for the 30 days that he would be traveling. And that's just his pay. So I'm thinking we're talking a minimum of maybe $2,000 there or so. And then he has travel money. So for whatever he was, however he was traveling, they would have given him money for either the bus or the train or the airline. Also, you get money for meals, per diem. So, and for 30 days, that really adds up. And I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't have $3,500, maybe $4,000 on him. And then, you know, here's a guy all by himself. He doesn't need to be anywhere for 30 days. He's got $3,000 or $4,000 on him. It just seems to me that would be the reason he disappeared, rather than, you know, some met a stranger who decided to kill him or something like that. This just seems to be much more likely. And again, that takes you back to, well, who would he have been with that day? And that, well, probably people that he knew, somebody that was willing to give him a ride, not only to the post office to mail these packages, but to whatever mode of transportation he was going to use to get to wherever he was going to try to get to. And it doesn't seem like there was ever any sign that he went anywhere, because the last sign of life, again, was in San Diego on June 18th from a package he mailed and a telephone call he made. Plus, we had just returned from a really intense six-month deployment, and now he was on his way to what would be considered a real cushy assignment. First of all, it's a school. It's a classroom setting. It's in Corey Station, Florida, which is a really nice area. So he kind of, you know, had all the good stuff in front of him for at least the foreseeable future. So that wouldn't be the time that you would disappear if you really couldn't handle what was going on with us on the ship in the Navy during Desert Storm. You'd probably disappear during one of our port calls, you know, in the Philippines or Bahrain or one of those places. You wouldn't wait till we get all the way back home to San Diego and then disappear there, I wouldn't think.
Captain Barnett had similar thoughts about the probability of Jason having a large amount of cash on him.
So I told the investigator from the NCIS that the real thing that stands out is that when a sailor is detached from the ship, especially if he's been gone for 6 months like we were gone, he's got a lot of money because he didn't spend very much because we didn't, you know, you were out in the middle of the Persian Gulf in a war. So he had money that he had earned over the course of, say, he started broke, right? In 6 months, he would have had several thousands of dollars earned to be paid to him. He would have been detached with pay for his travel and his per diem, what he would have to spend to eat, getting from the ship to his next station. And he would have been paid in advance because he would have had about a month to get to the next station. They would have given him a month's pay in advance. So he would have walked off the ship with close to, you know, pick a number, $8,000 in his pocket or so, which anytime at any place is pretty large amount of money. I don't know how he took the money, whether he took it in cash. They certainly could have taken it in cash. He could have taken some in check and some in cash. We didn't have direct deposit. Nowadays, all the money goes direct. Oh, by the way, he would have had a reenlistment bonus, too. They would have given him some extra money because he had reenlisted. So he would be a pretty tempting target for somebody to rob. Now, would they murder him? I don't know, but I don't doubt that he's foul play was involved, because he's just not the type of person who would just disappear. And if he did, 30 years later, the odds are that somewhere along the line he would have got tripped up. I think the worst is the most likely situation. The question who did it was something that NCIS was looking into. You know, my observation would be that the first place to check would be with his shipmates who he worked with daily. They have talked to some, I understand, and some have not talked. And then there's one who seems to be less than a solid citizen.
With it still being a mystery as to how Jason planned to travel from San Diego to Pensacola, learning that Sloan had also gone to Corey Station, Rachel has wondered if Jason could have planned to go with him.
He was going to Quarry Station. And Sloan also went to Quarry Station. You know, early on, I thought, well, you know, they're both EWs. They're both going to Slurry Station. What if Jason got a ride with him to Quarry Station? Because they still don't know how Jason was going to be traveling. He didn't have a driver's license.
Since Chief Williamson seemed to be pushing this deserter narrative from the very beginning, it seems like the Navy really bought into that until Rachel began making noise about the case when she grew up. Unfortunately, the amount of time that has passed has really hampered their investigative efforts. Things that could have or should have been done in 1991 simply weren't.
What I mentioned before, I spoke to people who were on the ship, and nobody knew that he had gone missing. So that tells me nobody even went back to the ship and said, hey, you guys were the last ones to see Jason. Who did he hang out with? Who took him to the airport? Who took him to the bus station? You know, or even it was just a month after he left, they could have even gone right to the ship's personnel office and said, how was he getting to Florida? Was he getting a ride with somebody? Did you guys give him airline tickets or did you just give him cash? That kind of thing. None of that was ever done. There never was a case other than just those guys verifying that he was away without leave and a UA, as we called it, unauthorized absence, and then eventually declaring him a deserter. There was never any investigation as to what happened to him. So that didn't happen until starting in 2016. As far as I know, since then they have located pretty much all of the guys that he worked with directly, hit what we call his shop, the other EWs, and they're trying to put together something based on that. And I verified that when I talked to a lot of the people that were still back on the ship at that time, guys who knew him. I would say, hey, did you know that Jason Dyes disappeared in 1991, right after he left Horn, never showed up to Quarry Station for his next school? And they were all like, no, I had no idea. That's really surprising. So in other words, no investigator ever contacted them back in 1991 and said, hey, do you know what happened to Jason? He's gone. You know, that's very unfortunate because you wait 25 years after something happens, it's going to be a lot harder to investigate. But I really feel confident that if more than one person knows what happened to Jason, the more publicity we can get, and the more questions that are asked, eventually the truth very well may come out, even after all these years.
You heard in the 2019 NCIS presentation that Sloan has not spoken to them. After the presentation was released to the public, Sloan was upset.
The video came out in 2019. He got upset and said they made him look like a fool or something. I'm kind of paraphrasing there, but because I don't remember exactly what he said. But he got mad because it made him look bad. Was all he was concerned about, was that it made him look bad. And then he told me not to message him or text him. If I had any questions, I could forward them through NCIS. And I said, well, you haven't contacted them. They've been trying. They would leave cards on his door and he wouldn't call any of them back. I said, will you be interviewed? I said, you said you would, but you're not. You're not accepting an interview from them. And then he blocked me. So I haven't had any contact with him since. This was the weirdest thing because everybody up until I met him was super eager to help. Strange people offering weird theories, and everybody wanted to help, except for him.
Rachel told us that growing up, her ideas about what may have happened to her cousin shifted with time.
I was afraid growing up. I think their fear kind of seeped into me as a kid, so I thought, always imagine the Navy as this bad entity that did something to my cousin. And then, you know, I started... You kind of fantasize a little bit about what may have happened. So then I started thinking, well, maybe he is a spy and he's out there fighting bad guys and keeping us, everybody safe from bad people in the world. And then, you know, my grandparents and the Nan, they started dying. Then I started going through a different stage where I'm like, well, if he's alive, he needs to come home because everybody's dying. He needs to be here for us. He should have had someone looking for him the whole time. My mom and dad did do a search for him, like a computer search. They had a retired police chief. He ran a search in the databases they have, and he said he's never seen, I had the report, I saved it, my mom saved it, and he said he'd never seen a file so empty. I always kind of had this hope he was alive. The stories the NCIS presentation, like, oh my gosh, they probably killed him. I can't imagine why. It's horrible to think if they killed somebody just because they didn't like him. Or maybe he was better than them. I kind of think maybe that's what it was. Early on, before I knew about the New York rumor, before I knew Sloan was involved in any way, I found him and I said, hey, I said, did you know anything about my cousin? Did anyone dislike him? Because that was a feeling I had that maybe he didn't fit in. When I ordered that cruise book and I saw those goofy pictures and how people cut up, I'm like, oh, you know, Jason would have been out of his element there. He's a computer nerd. He wouldn't have been as rowdy. And that was a thought. That was a concern that he didn't fit in. People made fun of him or bullied him. So I asked that to Sloan, did anyone dislike him early on? And Sloan never answered it.
At the very end of his speech at the reunion, Special Agent Keith made a plea for more information. I'm going to play this clip for anyone in the audience who may have some information that could help their investigation.
Here's what we need your help with. Anybody knows where any of those records are or could be or who might have them? What barracks did EW3 Dyes and his shipmates stay in upon return from Desert Storm? We know it was somewhere here on Naval Base San Diego. We just don't know which one. That would really help us if someone knew or could remember who had any contact with or even observed EW3 Dyes from June 7th, the day of your return from Desert Storm, thereon. How was he intending to travel to sea school, like I mentioned? Who had any contact with any of the EWs that I listed earlier from June 7th through July 18th, the day he was supposed to return? Did anyone ever visit EW3 Christensen's address, the one that was off base, the one that married Mooney 2 days after he got back? Did anyone go to this address? Did he have a party there? Did anyone visit him? We need your help. NCIS would greatly appreciate anyone with any information whatsoever to contact us.
So what happened to Jason Dyes after he mailed those packages to his family on June 18th, 1991? The circumstances of this case seemed to be the perfect storm for someone to get away with murder. The Navy was looking for Jason, but only considering him a deserter. They weren't looking at him as being a possible victim. Therefore, decades went by, possible evidence lost, and people's memories were getting foggier with each passing year. When Rachel grew up and began to pursue this, going down every possible avenue she could think of, she got a missing case opened in Florida, and she enlisted the help of Joe, who had an online community of sailors who had been on the same ship as Jason. And eventually she got NCIS to open up a cold case investigation. This is when she began conversing with Sloan online and uncovered this story about him calling Christensen to report that Jason didn't make it to Corey Station. Sloan reported that Christensen said that Jason was picked up in New York for writing bad checks. We have no clue if this phone call actually happened, but Sloan has since avoided Rachel and has not responded to NCIS and their requests for an interview. When Sloan got to Corey Station, could he have been looking for Jason because it was someone he knew, and that's why he called Christensen to inquire? Or does he know more about what happened to Jason? Beyond Sloan, there's Christensen and Chief Williamson, who were known to dislike Jason. Christensen allegedly made up this New York story. It also appears that there was some effort made by Chief Williamson to smear Jason's name by saying things like he was into bomb making, frequently in trouble, and wanted to desert. There was no evidence supporting his claims against Jason. By all accounts, Jason had a good work ethic and a promising career in the Navy. What remains unclear at this point is what motive any of them would have had to harm Jason. We know that they didn't like him. Could Jason have been targeted because he had a large amount of cash? Both Joe and Captain Barnett stated that he would have received thousands of dollars at the time. We know that he didn't put it in his bank account because his account only has around $500 in it. It's hard to piece together the clues in this case because so much remains unknown. We don't even know how Jason planned to travel to Florida. While there are plenty of reasons to be suspicious of Sloan, Christensen, and Williamson, is it possible that something happened to Jason during his trip? Rachel is hoping that someone listening to this story may remember Jason and come forward with some of the puzzle pieces she's desperately seeking. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jason Dyes, please call NCIS at 850-452-4211.
You know, if we can keep this elevated a little bit and keep some interest in it, then I think even just the fact of your podcast, you know, maybe it's like, you know, fishermen put some chum out there on the water to attract some fish, and then you know, the big one comes behind that. That's the one you're looking for.
I'd really like to know for sure that he's gone by having a body or remains or something. But if it's a true, honest confession of we did this or I did this, and, you know, we dumped his body and it's probably never going to be found, but yes, I did this, then that would be good enough. I just want to know. It drives you nuts thinking about it. I have this weird feeling, you know, that we're going to figure out what happened. It's just like, it seems like it's taken forever.
That brings us to the end of episode 229. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Join me next week. I'll be covering a case from Illinois. Thanks for listening.
How to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.